You're listening to a community meeting of the Citizens for Agricultural and Rural Responsibility in Hector, New York, on the topic of the spreading of sewage sludge on local farmland. This meeting took place on May 15th, and there's going to be a second meeting for those who missed the first one, and residents of surrounding towns and counties are also welcome because this may be an issue for you as well. The next meeting will be held Thursday, May 22nd, at the Mecklenburg Firehouse at 7:30 p.m. You can find out more information online at carrcny.org. I'll give that information again at the conclusion of this talk. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. We'll continue now with the conclusion of the community meeting.
What can Hector citizens do? We basically have four choices as far as we can tell. You may come up with a fifth. We can do nothing. We can hope for the best. We can hope that enough people get informed and will make good decisions, as have been made from some of our local farmers. We can encourage the DEC to enforce its own regulations more strongly, but as we've talked about, those regulations don't seem to be strong enough, and the EPA regulations really don't have our best interests at heart. We can write a town ordinance trying to strengthen those regulations, but that kind of puts a lot of responsibility on the town to enforce. The last option, and this has been used by a number of towns in Pennsylvania, as far as I know, and of course you can speak to that, is we can, as Hector residents, we can write and present a town ordinance and try to get it passed that prohibits the land application of sludge in the town of Hector. And that's something that, you know, we want to kind of hear from you, whether that seems like a place you think we might want to go. Basically, you know, CAR, Citizens for Agricultural and Rural Responsibility, you know, we've just come together around this issue. And, you know, we can move forward on this. If you think, you know, well, you know, we'd like to look at what an ordinance might look like and what are some considerations there, we stand at the ready. So in a way, I'm actually curious, or, you know, how many people would like more information about, you know, an ordinance? I mean, if you just kind of straw poll or want to hear more about what, you know, banning sludge might look like for this town. Okay, well, I'm glad to see that. Okay, well, that's the first thing. There's the mailing list so that we can give you information. There's also, we also have at this table, if you want to sign a petition, kind of just expressing your concern about sludge, that could be really helpful to us if we do end up doing an ordinance. I mean, is there anyone on the panel who wants to speak to that ordinance a little bit? You've had a lot of experience with that. Obviously, a lot of people are interested in hearing about that. And if you don't mind using the microphone.
Valerie Gardner, Democracy New York.
Basically, what's been happening in different places, Pennsylvania is one, New Hampshire is one, Virginia is working on ordinances right now, is that folks in communities, as I mentioned earlier, seem to be realizing that there is no place for redress when you have these kinds of concerns, because we're acknowledging that DEC is not there to protect us. They're there to issue permits and to enforce regulations that are wholly inadequate to protect your public safety and health. So what are the options for a community? You know, as was just mentioned, you can do nothing, or you can try and go down the regulatory route, which is really not satisfactory. I, for years, worked on environmental issues. Again, pro bono is just something that I did volunteer because I cared about the issues with the communities that I worked with. And came to the realization that, you know what, I may be a lawyer, boy, I'm willing to do anything I can for them, but the reality is that the structure isn't set up to protect people. And it's not set up to protect communities from tremendous damage to everything from socially, economically. These kinds of things really damage relationships. They pit neighbor against neighbor. So what now has really rejuvenated my hopes for how communities can handle these things is what we're seeing happen in these other places. And what is happening is that people are coming together and they're daring to say no. Even though if you go to your attorneys, mind you, most attorneys are trained just like I was. So before I had this exposure, I would have said, okay, well, here's what we can do. We can, you know, go to the through the permitting process and we can ask for some extra safeguards. And by the way, they really don't have to give you any. They might just, you know, agree to it to keep us off their back. But there really aren't. The safeguards for public health and safety in these issues is just not built into it because, again, DEC is a permitting authority. That's all they are. And as far as enforcement goes, and we've seen this time and time again, and I can personally vouch for this, even from the folks that work at DEC, they don't have people to enforce this stuff. They don't have the staff to do it. They don't have the budget to do it. They just don't have the ability to do it, no matter how much they may want to. So what do you do instead when you've got the state that might say, oh, no, you can't get into regulating this little town because that's our job? And you might hear, particularly with the issue of sewage sludge, Ag and Markets Law 305A is known as the right to farm section of the Ag and Markets Law. And what that does is it gives the state sort of a preemptive authority to determine anything with what's a sound agricultural practice. There is an exception to that, though, but quite often you'll never hear about the exception. You'll just hear the threat from the state that you can't do that because we have full authority, exclusive authority to regulate this. But the exception, even within that section of the law, is that except for public safety, health, and welfare. And so what the town does have the ability to do is to exert themselves. And this is, you know, mindful of it's not without some resistance that you'll do this, but your choices are to get it or to not get it. And maybe set yourself up to be able to handle other infringements in the future as well. But you have provisions in the New York State Constitution that specifically empower local governments to protect the health, safety, welfare, and property of your locality. Those same provisions are echoed again in our New York State statute, and the name of the statute is the Home Rule Law for New York. And well recognized is the locality's police power too, and the policing power is the right to protect health, safety, and welfare. So exerting the town's right to pass a binding local law, and I want you to pay attention to the binding local law part of this because this is what's been working in other places. We are not talking about a zoning regulation. That is not what I'm advocating at all because the law is very clear. Zoning is about separating incompatible uses of land. It is not about anything else. So in terms of zoning, you can regulate whether or not you have a single-family house next to an industrial facility, but that's about all it's good for. It's not designed to deal with these kind of issues. And clearly, you cannot zone out of your township any legal use. So if you use zoning to do this, you're nowhere. Don't bother. You really have to look at passing a binding local law that reflects what the community believes is necessary to protect their health, safety, and welfare. And that includes your property values. That includes your watershed. That includes all of those things that you value on top of your health. So the way other communities have done this is that they've come together, they've used the model that was introduced to us. In fact, we had used this a portion of this model in Yates County dealing with some issues a while back and just did not at that time have a good sense of how to finish it. Now we've seen these ordinances that have been used in Pennsylvania. Specifically, I'm speaking about Pennsylvania because there are numerous towns in Pennsylvania that have passed these ordinances. There's a very specific approach to it. It's a little too detailed to get into now, but many of them are directed at application of sewage sludge, and not one drop has been spread in those towns. Not one drop. Not one drop. So I guess, you know, my husband and I, we are with a not-for-profit called Democracy New York. We are totally volunteer time. This is just important to us to be able to return, you know, to our communities some of what we've learned. Democracy New York was formed after we were exposed to the democracy schools, which taught about what was going on in Pennsylvania back in 2005 when we had our first democracy school at Watson Homestead. Democracy New York right now is in the process of, we have been trying to bring that message to New York so that communities would be aware of the other options that are available. One of the things that we are doing a little bit differently is that we've set up a New York-based approach here so that folks in New York can really start to utilize this approach. And so we're available if folks need us to come in and do some community rights forums for them and assist in those ways in as much as we can. So we're open to that. However you guys need us, we'll be glad to help.
So before you ask that question, so I just want to, again, take a little straw poll. You know, Carr does sound ready, and Bob especially has looked at a lot of these ordinances. You know, we can pull together, you know, something that we think might work and have another meeting where we could explain what an ordinance prohibiting the application of sewage sludge might look like. And again, you know, if you who thinks that they would be interested in attending such a meeting, kind of to see if that's where we want to go as a community. Wonderful. That gives us a really good idea of, you know, where we can go. Stefan, if you wanted one last, we know it's getting late. Thank you so much for listening for so long. I want to wrap this up.
Moving town government can be really hard. It takes a lot of people in the town to even get to the point of any kind of local legislation. All of us are going to have to go out to talk to neighbors and bring folks in.
And if I could just respond to that really quickly, that was the key in the communities that were successful doing this, is building that community majority. It's the hardest part of what you have to do, is to let your neighbors know what's going on and keep people engaged, but that is absolutely essential. So I would, you know, second that.
And so, last slide, fits right in. Again, please sign up for, you know, either through emails, get information about our website or our phone number. If you want to sign the petition that shows your concern. And this is not about blaming anyone. This is about being proactive. And we will get back in touch with you. We will pull together something and see, you know, what makes sense. Being proactive makes sense. Once this stuff gets applied, it's really, as Valerie pointed out, it's very difficult to go back and stop it. It's really about kind of getting ahead of the curve here. Thank you so much for coming. We really, really appreciate it.
You've been listening to a community meeting on the topic of the prevention of sewage sludge spreading in Hector, New York, sponsored by CAR, Citizens for Agricultural and Rural Responsibility. There will be another meeting on this topic Thursday, May 22nd, that's this coming Thursday, in Mecklenburg at the Firehouse on McIntyre Road at 7:30 p.m. If you'd like to contact CAR, I'm going to give you a website and a phone number. The website is carrcny.org. The phone number is 387-8214. That's in the 607 area code, 387-8214.
There are places where there are hills. They're not just called hills, they're really hills. And there are places where there are forests, not like 12 pines, but really forests. There are places where the birds sing. You can hear the eagle call. I know they're out there, somewhere beyond the mall. There are places where there are rivers, not surrounded by concrete, but living rivers with fish in them and frogs and little tadpoles, with ducks and deer drinking by the sinkholes. There are places far away, the trees turn colors in the fall. No, they're out there, somewhere beyond the mall. There are places you can see the sky, not neon signs and billboards, but just the sky. There are places with dirt on the ground, without miles of asphalt, not a car around, where on and in the soil good little critters crawl. No, they're out there, somewhere beyond the mall. There are places like that, and things don't have to be like this. I mean, not just cosmetic changes, things really don't have to be like this. There are places where people know their neighborhood, where people live there, and they think that life is good. There are places like that, somewhere on this spinning ball. I know they're out there, somewhere beyond the mall. There are places that I know I've gotta find, otherwise I will undoubtedly lose my mind. Otherwise I'll end up just like you on Ritalin or Prozac or whatever things you do. I'm going where the water is blue and the trees are oh so tall. I know they're out there, somewhere beyond the mall.
Somewhere Beyond the Mall by David Rovix. I think of that as a theme song for Schuyler County. One thing that can be hard for people to face is the extent to which government does the bidding of corporations at the expense of the general welfare. Key to this is the manipulation of public opinion. We'll conclude the program with a talk by Sheldon Rampton, who co-authored with John Stauber a number of books on the use of propaganda and the public relations industry. Among their books, Toxic Sludge is Good for You and Trust Us, We're Experts. Rampton spoke on May 8th to an audience at the headquarters of Google.
My name is Keith. I'm an engineer here on the Build Tools team. I brought Sheldon here because I think the work that he and everybody at the Center for Media and Democracy is doing is really important. Because obviously the media sort of shapes, you know, they frame what we think of as green, what we think of as politically feasible, morally justifiable. The media are heavily influenced by corporations, so it's sort of like, you know, our ideology is being shaped by these corporate PR organizations. So I think it's great to be uncovering that stuff and becoming aware of it, and that's what Sheldon is doing. So we welcome Sheldon Rampton from CMD.
Well, the title of my talk, as you can see from the screen, is The Wires That Control the Public Mind. I'll explain the meaning of that phrase a little later. Maybe the meaning is self-evident. This is the organization I work for, the Center for Media and Democracy. Our website is prwatch.org. We started off as a watchdog organization monitoring the public relations industry from an almost unremittingly negative perspective. There are PR firms that don't engage in sleazy, deceptive practices, but if they do, we don't write about them. Every so often, we'll get someone from a PR firm contacting our office and saying, could you do a story about our firm? And our standard answer is, are you doing anything unethical? And then they quickly get off the phone and say, we like you guys. So we started doing this about 15 years ago, and I'd like to explain a little bit about how we got into it. Spies for Hire. My co-author, John Stauber, with whom I've now written several books, founded the center after running into this woman, Diane Moser. John is a longtime environmental activist, and back in the 1980s, 1990s, he was involved in a campaign opposing the plans by the Monsanto company to introduce genetically engineered bovine growth hormone into the marketplace. BGH is a genetically engineered hormone that you inject into cows to force them to give more milk. And various groups were concerned about that. There were environmental concerns. Farm groups were concerned that it was actually going to be bad for farmers. Consumer groups, there were health concerns. And so there was a coalition that formed around these issues. And at one point, they received a phone call from this woman. She said, my name is Diane Moser, and I'm with a group called the Maryland Citizens Consumer Council, and we're also concerned about bovine growth hormone. We'd like to join the coalition and attend your meetings. They thought nothing of that and said, sure, held a meeting. A little later, she came to it. And then a month later, someone connected to Monsanto was sort of boasting to a reporter that they had a mole in the meeting. And the reporter called one of the people in the coalition and said, did you know that Monsanto had a spy in your meeting? And they said, no. Did a little checking, and there was only one person at the meeting that no one else knew, Diane Moser. Did a little more checking. They discovered that the Maryland Citizen Consumer Council, in fact, did not exist, and that Diane Moser worked for a public relations firm, one of the world's largest PR firms called Burson Marsteller. Even though it's a very large company, I'm sure many of you have not heard of it. Most people have not heard of the PR firms that work behind the scenes to shape public perceptions. And most of us, when we think about what PR firms do, probably picture some insincere guy in a suit, you know, spinning a line, someone like Michael J. Fox on Spin City. You don't think about someone infiltrating meetings of environmental activists, but that, in fact, is what they did. Well, John's reaction to all this was to get quite irate. He said, I'm going to get these people. His idea of how to get them was to start writing about them, and he contacted me. And by then, John had also gotten some information about the guy you see in this picture here. Bud Vestermark was going around to animal rights groups. It turned out he was working with a PR firm called Mongoven, Bisco & Duchin. After they figured out what he was up to, they managed to catch a photograph of him. And John had written up this very intriguing article about these PR firms skulking around and spying on people. And he said, I'm going to start up a publication, call it PR Watch. And I said, you know, this is a pretty interesting story you've written here. But, you know, after we do the first issue, is there really enough information about something like public relations? Are we ever going to do a second issue? And that was 15 years ago. So we've been finding dirt regularly ever since and having kind of a good time with it. After we'd done it a couple of years, we wrote a book titled Toxic Sludge is Good for You, Lies, Damn Lies in the Public Relations Industry. The title was intended satirically. We did not really think that there would be a PR campaign out there telling people literally that toxic sludge is good for you until we got a phone call from this woman, Nancy Blatt, who explained that she was with an organization called the Water Environment Federation. And she had heard we were writing this book, and she'd heard the title. And she was concerned that the word sludge in the title might actually be bad for the image of sludge. It turns out that the Water Environment Federation is the main trade association representing sewage treatment plants. Well, sewage treatment plants are what are responsible for filtering everything that goes into the water that you flush down the toilet or down the drain, before it goes back into, you know, rivers, lakes, and streams. before they started filtering that stuff out, there was a serious problem with water quality. One lake actually caught on fire. So the fact that they're filtering that stuff out is certainly a good thing. But then they end up with this product, the residue of the treatment process that combines everything from, you know, pesticides to, you know, human excrement, and that's what sewage sludge is. And disposing of that is a dilemma. We're talking, you know, tons and tons and tons of material. And they've tried, you know, burying it in landfills. It ends up contaminating the groundwater. They've tried dumping it in the ocean. That ends up creating a big, you know, problem with fish kills. They've tried incinerating it, but then the ash rains down to earth again. So the most recent plan, the one that they've been pushing forward, that they were pushing when they contacted us, is to use it as fertilizer and spread it on farm fields. They quickly discovered a problem with that, which is that if you contact a farmer and said, we have this product we want you to spread on your farm, and it's sewage sludge, that it turns people off. So they decided we're not going to call it sludge anymore. They call it biosolids. They actually appointed something called the Name Change Task Force and had a contest to come up with a new name. These are some of the candidates that were rejected. All Growth, Pura Nutri, BioLife, BioSlurp, Skadoo. I kind of like Humanure. Urban Biomass, I like that one. NutriCake, that's getting kind of optimistic. And my personal favorite, of course, is ROSE, which is short for Recycling of Solids Environmentally. They finally settled on biosolids. By the way, after this first call that we got from Nancy Blatt asking us to she was actually hoping we would change the title of our book. She wanted us to change it to something like Smoking is Good for You, just so we wouldn't use the word sludge, for God's sake. After she realized we weren't going to do that, and after we got kind of interested in their campaign to rename sludge, she stopped returning our calls. Some of the information we got about this, the Water Environment Federation works with the Environmental Protection Agency on some of its projects, and so there's taxpayer money involved. So the way we got some of this information was actually, ultimately, we had to file a Freedom of Information Act request. And we discovered that after the Name Change Task Force had done its work, that their next step was they wanted to add the word biosolids to the dictionary. So they contacted Merriam-Webster, the dictionary people. Merriam-Webster said, well, you know, you can't just coin a word and we'll put it in the dictionary. It doesn't work that way. They said, how does it work? Well, we have to see evidence of the word being used. We have to see publications that are actually using it. And if we see those and we see enough of them, then we'll evaluate. And at some point, if it's used enough, we'll put it in the dictionary. So they said, well, we can do that. And directives went out to everyone who works in the field of wastewater treatment saying, don't use the word sludge anymore. Always use the word biosolids. And then they started mailing examples of that to Merriam-Webster. See, it's being used. It's being published. It's being used. One of the memos we got through our Freedom of Information Act request is from Pete Machno of the National Biosolids Partnership, in which he explains that Merriam-Webster is going to use the word, and he's pleased that the term sludge will not appear in the definition. So here's the definition that appears now in Merriam-Webster. Biosolids is the solid organic matter recovered from a sewage treatment process and used especially as fertilizer. This reminds me of George Orwell's book, 1984, which depicts a future in which a totalitarian world engages in mind control. And one of the ways they do that in particular is by controlling language. They've invented a new version of English they call Newspeak. And in an appendix to the book, Orwell describes the rules of Newspeak. There's a category of words that he calls the B words, which consist of two or more words or portions of words welded together in an easily pronounceable form. The usual care was taken to define them carefully and strip them of undesirable meanings. Well, that's a description of mind control in a terrifying, totalitarian, cruel dictatorship. And it's not the world we live in, but as the biosolids example illustrates, there are parts and moments when we come uncomfortably close. Biosolids, you just weld them together and strip them of undesirable meanings, and you've got a new word so that people don't have to think about the fact that what they're spreading on their farm is sewage sludge. Well, how did this come to be? To understand the history of propaganda in the modern world, it helps to understand the career of Edward Bernays, Eddie, as they called him in the PR profession. Bernays he was born in 1891 and lived until 1994, died at the age of 103. He used to say that what he did was propaganda, and he hoped it wasn't impropaganda. He's known as the father of public relations. He was also a nephew of Sigmund Freud twice over, meaning that his mother was married to, I think, Freud's brother, and Freud was married to another Bernays. So he was a cousin twice over. I've often wondered where Freud got his ideas about the incest taboo. But Bernays himself was heavily influenced by Freud's ideas. He arranged translations of some of Freud's books into English and was the author himself of books with titles such as Crystallizing Public Opinion, The Engineering of Consent, and Propaganda. And he got a lot of his ideas about human nature and how to influence it from studying the example of his famous Uncle Sigmund. Here's a brief history of spin. Ivy League and Edward Bernays got their start as wartime propagandists during the First World War. You may recall from your history books that Woodrow Wilson ran for re-election to president on the campaign slogan, "He kept us out of war." That was because the First World War was seen in the United States as a largely European affair, and people simply did not want to see the United States become involved. So for the purpose of the campaign, at least, Wilson ran on the slogan of, "He kept us out of war." And as soon as he got elected, set about very aggressively getting us into World War I. And in order to do that, a PR campaign was necessary in order to sell the war to the American people. A committee was set up called the Committee for Public Information, and Ivy Lee and Edward Bernays and other people went to work for it. The picture you see, the poster that says, "I want you for the U.S. Army," that's become famous, was created by the Committee for Public Information. They designed posters, they designed movie newsreels, they had people go into theaters before performances and give talks. They designed the war bond campaign. And in the process, they developed a lot of the techniques that became used later on by the public relations industry. One thing that I think is important to notice about this is that under the pressure of war, the very nature of communications was redefined. It came to be seen as a set of techniques for manipulating the thinking of target audiences. I'm going to show a little clip here from a Department of Defense training film from the 1950s where they explain their understanding of this concept of target audiences.
This indicates that the target audiences can be broken down into three basic groups: the subversives, the government supporters, and then the big group in the middle, the uncommitted civilians. Any PSYOP effort will have to encompass.
Okay, you get the idea. Here's Bernays talking himself about the lessons taught by the war. Propaganda was then taken over after the war by other interests, and propaganda became a well-organized part of business. Bernays, through his training, through his background, through, you know, in Freudian theory, came to see public relations as a sort of applied science. He said that the Council on Public Relations is what sociologists call a societal technician, just as a psychologist helps clients, you know, come to terms with their neuroses. His idea is that public relations is basically a way of adapting people to society, and so you have these practicing social scientists who are responsible for shaping the thinking of the rest of us. The term human herd is a term that he used himself. He would say that people are herd-like. People are subject to the passions of the pack. The mind of the average citizen is the greatest barrier between him and the facts. His own logic, his own absolutism are the obstacles that prevent him from seeing in terms of experience and thought rather than in terms of group reaction.
So Bernays did not have a very high opinion of human intelligence. Fortunately, the solution was this special class that he envisioned of opinion manipulators. And, you know, he thought you could do it almost scientifically. If you understand the mechanisms of the group mind, you can control and regiment the masses according to our will without their knowing it. In certain cases, we can affect some change with a fair degree of accuracy by operating certain mechanisms, just as the motorist can regulate the speed of his car. And he went on to say, those who manipulate this unseen mechanism of society constitute an invisible government, which is the true ruling power of our country. He saw this as a good thing. This is a logical result of the way in which our democratic society is organized. And so, in almost every act of our lives, the relatively small number of people who understand how to pull the wires can control the public mind. Well, that was Edward Bernays writing, you know, 50 plus years ago. But these kinds of ideas, this assumption about the nature of humanity and about the need to manipulate people is still very much a factor in the way people think today. This is a quote from a few years ago from James Lindeheim, who is the worldwide director of public affairs for the Burson Marsteller PR firm. This is the same PR firm I mentioned earlier that sent Diane Moser to infiltrate the group that my co-author was part of. He says, some very interesting psychological and sociological research on risk perception suggests that the obvious rational approach is not likely to succeed when you're talking to the public. In fact, the research tells us that people's perceptions of the sizes of various risks are based on emotional and not rational factors. Okay? What he's talking about, of course, he's working for one of their clients is the chemical industry. He's talking about the fact that people's perception of the risks from things like toxic chemicals are irrational. So you have to deal with them at an emotional level rather than talk about the fact. We are in the realm of the illogical, the emotional, and we must respond with the tools that we have for managing the emotional aspects of the human psyche. This sounds just like Edward Bernays. The industry must be like the psychiatrist, rationally figuring out how it can help the public put things in perspective, but knowing that dialogue can only begin with a trust on the public's part that says these people are taking my concerns seriously. I kind of really like the contrast in this quote where he begins by saying, people are just crazy, emotional. You're like, you have to be a psychiatrist just to deal with them. And the way you deal with them is that you win their trust by convincing them that you're taking their concerns seriously. I just sometimes wonder how someone can utter these things and not realize how massively he's contradicting himself. This is from the website of Burson Marsteller, where they explain what they do. Perceptions are, they say they're in the business of perception management. How important are they? Well, in the news just in the last month or so, Burson Marsteller's CEO, Mark Penn, resigned from Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign. PR people like and PR firms like Burson Marsteller are these days advise presidents and other politicians. Penn resigned, by the way, because Hillary Clinton has publicly been declaring that she's opposed to the North American Free Trade Agreement. Penn got in a little bit of trouble because simultaneously he was working for the government of Colombia to lobby in favor of NAFTA. Burson Marsteller has also done a number of anti-union projects, and that was jeopardizing Hillary Clinton's support with labor unions. Interestingly, although he resigned, he's still working for the campaign. This is perception management at work. I guess he's just not working for them in an official capacity anymore, even though he's still being paid. Here's another PR firm, Hill & Knowlton, also kind of a legend in the PR industry, again expressing this idea that when dealing with issues of risk and public perception, it's people's emotions you have to deal with. It's not the hazard itself. Managing the outrage is more important than managing the hazard. There's even a PR firm run by a guy named Peter Sandman that sells a piece of software they call Outrage. I love the little screaming face there. Outrage is supposed to, it does things like it tells you how to deal with people who are mad at you. They gauge their critics on two axes. How much power do they have and how much passion do they have? And if someone has a lot of power and a lot of passion, well, you may have to defer to them but everyone else you can get rid of in some way. If they have power but not much passion, well, deflect them. You know, just change the subject. Their attention will wander, and then you don't have to do what they want. If they have no power but passion, then you have to defeat them. And if they have neither power nor passion, then you can just dismiss them. So that's the plan. As these examples illustrate, public relations, at least the type of public relations that John and I specialize in criticizing, it sees itself as a methodology for managing an unruly and hostile public. They use terms to describe what they do, such as crisis management, opinion management, issue management. And at the same time, they don't really trust the public or respect its intelligence. I think it could just as reasonably be called anti-public relations. So let's get into one of the most common techniques used to influence public opinion. It's known in the trade as the third-party technique, which means put your words in someone else's mouth. Corporations and other people trying to influence opinion have realized that if they come out and say something directly themselves that's a self-serving message, the public will see through it quite quickly because it's so obviously self-serving. So what you want to do is put your words in the mouth of someone who seems like an independent, trusted third party, preferably a third party expert of some kind. Here's how Bernays expressed the technique. How can the persuader reach those groups that make up the large public? He can do so through their leaders. For the individual looks for guidance to the leaders of the groups to which he belongs. So you find those leaders, you get them to say what you want, and through that, then you can mold the opinion of everyone else. One of the famous examples of that from Bernays' career was known as the Torches of Freedom Brigade that he organized as part of the 1929 Easter Day Parade. Smoking at the time was something that was considered taboo for women. It was considered unladylike. The president of one of the tobacco companies, American Tobacco, went to Bernays and he said, you know, we're losing half our market here. How can we get women to smoke? And Bernays hired a psychoanalyst, a disciple of Freud, to give him an opinion. And the psychoanalyst told him, well, for women, the cigarette is the symbol of the penis. And what you have to do is convince women that smoking cigarettes gives them their own penis and will liberate them. And in this opinion that this guy, that Brill wrote up, he used the phrase for women, tobacco's cigarettes could come to be seen as torches of freedom. That phrase is the main thing that Bernays got out of the session, I think. And so he arranged for a group of New York debutantes to march in the Easter Day parade. And at the appropriate moment, they whipped out cigarettes and started smoking them as an act of rebellion against the norms of a male-dominated society. Bernays also arranged to have photographers from newspapers standing by to photograph the protest, and this became a topic of instant controversy. It was on the front page of the New York Times, and people began talking about whether these women had behaved scandalously. Women began demanding to be admitted into all-male smoking clubs. And it quickly became the topic of advertisements like this one you see here. An ancient prejudice has been removed. You can now smoke. The taboo is broken. You're free. This, of course, then became the basis for subsequent advertising campaigns into fairly recent history, like the Virginia Slims tobacco brand whose whole marketing theme was feminism. You've come a long way, baby. Now you can smoke. Well, as this example illustrates, the third-party technique, where you put your words or even your cigarettes in someone else's mouth, it does several things. One, it offers camouflage. It hides the vested interest that's the true sponsor of the message. It encourages conformity to a vested interest while seeming to represent independence and even dissent. And most importantly, I think, it replaces factual discourse with emotion-laden symbolism. So that instead of talking about the something factual or substantial about things, you're talking about how people feel or what these symbols mean. Here's some examples of the third-party technique. I'll just skim over them. During Microsoft's antitrust case a few years ago, they paid a PR firm, Edelman, to actually ghostwrite letters that were then published in newspapers around the country. Saying that saying that Microsoft's, that the antitrust case was a misuse of government resources and should be dropped. A number of prominent economists were signatories to a full-page ad in the New York Times that was sponsored by the Independent Institute. 6 months later, it was discovered that the Independent Institute had been paid to run the ads by Microsoft. Boy, that's a shock. Mothers Opposing Pollution was a group in Australia. So this stuff happens around the world. They campaigned against plastic milk bottles, saying that the liquid cardboard, you know, milk cartons are better for the environment. It turns out that Mothers Opposing Pollution was a PR front for the manufacturers of the cardboard milk cartons. You can walk into grocery stores, pick up grocery, you know, walk down the cereal aisle, and you'll see, you know, sugar frosted flakes and cereals like that with labels on the side of them saying that the logo of the American Heart Association or the American Diabetic Association. What's happened, of course, is that the American Heart Association has been paid some money by the maker of the cereal, and the intent that they're trying to convey with that is that somehow the American Heart Association has endorsed this cereal as good to feed your kids, when in fact nothing is of the type has happened. They've just gotten some money to do it. Another example of the third-party technique, it's quite common actually, is ghostwriting for medical journals. You may remember the Fen-Phen diet drug disaster. It was pulled from the market after a number of people who took Fen-Phen suffered heart valve damage. There were lawsuits. During one of the lawsuits, a Dr. Richard Atkinson, whose name appeared as the lead author of a study about Fen-Phen that said it was, you know, a great thing to be using. It would really help people lose weight. One of the things they found was correspondence that Atkinson had written to the PR firm that was ghostwriting his study, in which he said, "Let me congratulate you on the great work of writing. Perhaps I can get you to write all my papers for me." My only general comment is that this piece may make dexfenfluramine sound better than it really is. The same doctor, when he was deposed, then they said he said he actually hadn't known that the PR firm was working for the company that made Fen-Phen. He said, "That kind of makes me a little uneasy." Here's another example in the field of politics. There's an organization that we exposed called Contributions Watch, declared itself to be an independent watchdog organization, the leading authority on money and politics in the states. It was supposed to monitor special interest group activity and be a resource to journalists about who's giving money in political campaigns. They wrote a number of studies. Thanks to a whistleblower, we discovered that Contributions was itself a creation of a PR firm secretly funded by Philip Morris. One of the tobacco industry's law firms had even written a script instructing people at Contributions Watch on what they could say if a reporter were to call and say, "Who's funding you?" To avoid answering the question, they were supposed to say, "Do you have some question about the accuracy of our numbers?" That's the important thing. The numbers speak for themselves. Another tobacco industry project called the White Coat Project. This was a response. This was an attempt to counteract evidence of health risks from secondhand cigarette smoke. The goal was to resist and roll back smoking restrictions. To generate these goals, the plan was to first generate a body of scientific and technical knowledge. The term white coat in this context refers to the white lab coats that doctors wear. The problem for the tobacco industry was they were getting hit by all this medical research showing that cigarette smoke is bad for the health. So I think it's rather illustrative of what's important to them, that the most important part of medical researcher to them is the white coat that they wear because of what it symbolizes. Covington and Burling, Philip Morris law firm, directly coached the White Coat Project, acted as a legal buffer, and they boasted in one of their memorandums. This gives you a sense of the scope of this kind of activity. They have created the world's only learned scientific society addressing questions of indoor air quality. It will soon have its own newsletter in which environmental tobacco smoke and other environmental air quality issues will be discussed in a balanced fashion balance means pro-tobacco, to an audience of regulators, scientists, building operators, etc. It will also have its own scientific journal published by a major European publishing house in which indoor air quality issues will again be addressed. So this is a massive project on which they spent millions of dollars. Another area in which the third-party technique is used is the creation of front groups. There's a project. This photograph was taken by a school teacher at a trade show, exactly. The organization is called Project Learning Tree, and you would think that this is a group that's about preserving trees. It's actually funded by the logging industry, and its main mission is to tell kids that it's okay to chop down old growth forests. Here's another group, the American Council on Science and Health. They've published books like Panic in the Pantry, where they say that public concerns about pesticides, pollution, and food additives are just irrational fears. Here are some of their funders: the American Meat Institute, Amoco, Archer Daniels Midland, Burger King, Coca-Cola, Coors. You can read the list. Shell Oil, the Sugar Association, and Union Carbide rounds out the list. The internet is also seen as a tool for spin, and just as they've engaged in the sort of spying I described at the beginning, they also use the internet as a tool for gathering intelligence about potential adversaries. One PR counselor said, "Here's how to use the web: eavesdrop all you want, learning the attitudes of specific audiences and the issues most important to them." There are also some specific web-based front groups. Here's one that was just launched recently called Sunlight Scam. Any guesses about who this represents? The makers of tanning booths. Okay, because there's a concern about cancer risk from ultraviolet radiation from baking in a tanning booth. So what they're saying is that's all a scam, and that dermatologists it's a scandal what these dermatologists are telling you. Another one set up by the same same PR firm is called Fish Scam, which is basically telling people that health risks from mercury are all cooked up and are ridiculous too. My favorite quote from Mulder and Scully: "The truth is out there." From the point of view of the people who manipulate public opinion, however, the truth is a very different thing from what most of us think it is. This modern scientific era is built on the idea that the truth is something you can get at through research and rational inquiry. According to Richard Edelman at Edelman Worldwide, one of the world's larger PR firms, "In this era of exploding media technologies, there is no truth except the truth you create for yourself. Marketing is a battle of perception, not products. Truth has no bearing on the issue," says someone else. So that's in a world where that kind of spin is going on, led by people who literally believe that there is no truth except the truth that you invent, it becomes harder and harder, I think, for the public to separate truth from reality, which is why it becomes possible to lead a nation to war on the basis of weapons of mass destruction that did not exist, and why 5 years later we're still fighting that war, to name just one example of the type of spin that goes on every day in our society.
Sheldon Rampton of the Center for Media and Democracy, speaking May 8th. You can find them on the web at prwatch.org. And you can download an MP3 of this and previous episodes of the show to pass around at unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening.